This is Fresh Air. I'm Ken Tucker, filling in for Terry Gross. My guest Kathleen Chalfant is currently starring off-Broadway at Manhattan's MCC Theater in a new play called Wit by Margaret Edson. It's about a middle-aged professor of English, an expert in the sonnets of the 17th century poet John Donne, who finds she has advanced ovarian cancer. This character, Vivian Baring, is a proud but solitary woman for whom her work has been her life. Now she finds that life about to end, and she's surrounded in the hospital in which the play takes place by a medical staff mostly unaware of her achievements as a scholar, and she's reduced to the anonymous, often humiliating status as a weak patient who must depend on people for virtually the first time in her life. Which is not to say there aren't light moments here. Early on in the play, she turns to the audience and says, "This play contains elements of humor. I think I die at the end." Kathleen Chalfant is perhaps best known for her work in the Pulitzer Prize-winning play Angels in America, for which she received a Tony nomination. Of her work in Wit, the New York Times said of her performance that it is, quote, "as intelligent and uncompromising as you're likely to come across on a New York stage." I asked her what drew her to this play.
I realized that it was wonderful writing. And as it happened, at the time that the play came to me, my brother, who has been my mentor and who died just after Easter this year, had been recently diagnosed with cancer and was planning to come to live with us in New York, which he subsequently did. And he was visiting, so I gave him the play because I wanted to know whether it was true to his experience, at least as far as he'd had that experience. And he read it and said two things. One, that it was entirely true, and the other, that if anyone ever asked me to do this play, I must do it.
Really?
Yes.
What did your brother do?
My brother had been in the restaurant business most of his life in San Francisco, and at the time of his death had just retired as the development director for the Hearing Society in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And he did a variety of things, including organizing a large San Francisco charity event called Dinner at Eight.
Mm-hmm. And did you spend a lot of time with him during the time that he was suffering from this?
Yes, he came to live with us,
mm-hmm.
and lived with us for nearly the last 2 years of his life.
Uh-huh. I wondered how you prepared for this role, which seems to take you into two extremes. First, there are those long, long speeches about John Donne that are really lectures, really, that explain this professor's love of language. Were these long speeches difficult to memorize, to kind of keep things straight, all of Donne's wordplay?
They actually weren't difficult to memorize because they're so well written. And the lecture on Donne is so carefully reasoned that it follows.
Mm-hmm.
And I think anyone who acts would agree that the better written the material is, the easier it is to learn.
Mm-hmm.
It seems inevitable after a while.
I wonder if I could ask you to just give me an example of how Vivian speaks of John Donne, because it's done in such an evocative way.
Okay, I'll do the beginning of Vivian's lecture.
Great. Thank you.
"The poetry of the early 17th century, what has been called the metaphysical school, considers an intractable mental puzzle by exercising the outstanding human faculty of the era, namely, wit, the greatest wit. The greatest English poet, some would say, was John Donne. In the Holy Sonnets, Donne applied his capacious, agile wit to the larger aspects of the human experience, life, death, and God."
It's really terrific. Thank you. Then there's the other extreme in the situation that your character is in, undergoing this intensive, even brutal cancer treatment. I understand you visited the Yale New Haven University Hospital.
Yes.
Was that in the way of research?
Yes, so we didn't visit patients at the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
We visited with an oncological gynecologist and with oncology nurses who were wonderful. and who were very forthcoming about the kinds of things that happen in the hospital. And they came back over and over to the play to kind of vet the technical part of the play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that anyone who's had any experience in hospitals, you know, can identify with her, the character's annoyance with this kind of forced mechanical cheeriness of the doctors and nurses. It's kind of this kind of insincere interest. Everyone's always asking Vivian how she's feeling, and she's always supposed to say very heartily, fine, even when she's feeling very awful. Do you find that this is something that audiences respond to, that they identify with?
Yes, audiences respond immediately. And to give the medical professionals their due, it's very difficult what they do. And a lot of these peculiar ways of speaking are their defenses against the terror of the job that they've been set to do.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that quite often there isn't anything to do. And they are trained, particularly physicians, are trained to do something.
Mm-hmm.
I found this out when I was helping with my brother at the end of his life. Even when it was clear that it was the end of his life, the doctors felt it necessary to do something,
mm-hmm.
rather than to just let him float away. Though when it was made clear that it was his choice to go away, they agreed.
Mm-hmm. Well, how did that experience with your brother inform your own interpretation of this role?
Well, when I first did the play, Alan was ill, and he came to see the play twice, and had some very important things to say about it. And the second time he came, he thought we were getting it right. He was very moved by it. When I came back to it a couple of months ago, I had had the experience of my brother's dying, and it was his last gift to me. And so I know something about the end of the play that I didn't know before, that I couldn't have known, and I think it's better.
Mm-hmm.
And I do also want to say that but when people write about the play, it seems like there's only this one character in the play, but
mm-hmm.
it's a play with 9 actors, and this company is an astounding company of actors who give, I think, the play its force and texture,
mm-hmm.
so that we're all very much doing this together. And we, most of us, have had the luxury of having a second go at the play.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I was going to say that your character, Vivian Baring, is surrounded by this hospital staff that, except for a very kind nurse, deals with you almost as a lab experiment. In particular, there's this young researcher who, in a very nice irony, took Vivian's class in metaphysical poetry. And so he's a man who has ideas about how to cure cancer, one of the most practical goals in the world. And I think that the tragedy of the play, it seems to me, is that he doesn't seem to make the connection that his own passion for medical research is the same as Vivian's passion for literary scholarship. It seems to me that she gets that, but he doesn't. Did you think of this character as providing kind of the conflict in the play with your character?
He provides both conflict and identification,
mm-hmm.
because in many ways, Jason and Vivian are very much alike, and
mm-hmm.
it's a parallel that Vivian draws in the play. And it should also be remembered that this character, Jason, Dr. Jason Posner, who is played by Alec Phoenix, did not choose to do clinical work. He means to be a researcher. And in a way, in the larger sense, the play is, I think, more an indictment of a sort of medical training program that puts people without any interest in clinical work in charge of living, breathing human beings.
Mm-hmm. Did your brother experience any of that, or were you witness to any of that kind of behavior between the patient and doctor?
Not to the same extent, because my brother wasn't in a research facility, mm-hmm. as Vivian is. Vivian mm-hmm. has joined a research protocol. What I did experience was a kind of endless and in some way unrealistic cheerfulness in the face of what was clearly death, so that it made it difficult to sort out how to live the last few months of my brother's life. The doctors kept insisting that he was either stable or perhaps getting better. And it was clear to all the people who were his caretakers and to himself mm-hmm. that that wasn't true.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a complicated situation.
And how did what response did that provoke in him? Was he angry about that? Was he frustrated?
He was frustrated. Because he was a layperson and they were physicians, he wasn't sure that he was right.
Mm-hmm.
He thought that he had failed in some way. You know, he wasn't trying hard enough to get well.
Mm-hmm.
And it, his last few months were not as peaceful as they could have been.
Mm-hmm. I'm talking to Kathleen Chalfant, who's starring in the off-Broadway play Wit. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actress Kathleen Chalfant. She stars in the off-Broadway play, Wit. I found the brief descriptions that I read of your own background fascinating. Your parents ran a boarding house in Oakland, California.
Yes, they did.
For, 50 people and served meals? And what was that experience like? Did you work with your parents growing up?
I did. My parents bought the boarding house at the beginning. I can't remember how old I was, but at the beginning of sixth grade, you mm-hmm. know, the way we all tell time by school, at the beginning of sixth grade, and we stayed there until I graduated from college. And I worked in the summers in the dining room waiting on tables, and I helped a little bit, you know, with maintenance and things, painting and all. My mother worked harder than anyone I know. And we had 5 employees.
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe 2 months a year were there ever all 5 of them there at one time. And my mother leapt into whatever breach was left.
What sort of people would be staying there? How big was this place?
It had 50 rooms. It had been a small hotel for the Southern Pacific Railroad. And it was working people for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an old-fashioned boarding house. We served breakfast and dinner to 50 people, sit-down meals, both of them. And then you could order lunch if you wanted to, sandwiches.
So how did you get interested in acting?
Well, I'd always been interested in acting. I got interested in acting because my grandmother, when I was younger, when my parents owned a motel in Sacramento, used to take me to the movies on Sunday when I was little. And I was, my brother's 14 years older than I, so I grew up most of the time as an only child, and he would be a third parent. So we'd come home from the movies, and I'd be alone and act out all the parts in the movies, especially Westerns, which I like quite a lot. And I think I wanted to be Lyle Waggoner for some reason, because I liked the way he smiled.
But,
and ride horses. In the boarding house, I continued that interest, and there was one of the women who lived in the boarding house, Florence Lonergan, was associated with a little theater in Alameda, which was the next town over from Oakland. And she took me there first, I guess, when I was about 14. And I began to work as an indentured servant, as people do in the theater. My father used to come and take me out of the theater and take me home. But, and I wasn't acting much. Mostly I was painting or, you know, helping out around the place. And that was my first experience in the theater. And I took over for somebody singing Shine On, Harvest Moon. And I don't sing. I didn't sing then, and I still don't sing. What was not perhaps an auspicious beginning. But. Uh-huh.
And did you study? Did you go to New York to study, or
No, I meant to study acting, but I went to Stanford, and which had a wonderful theater department then. But I ended up studying classical Greek.
Really?
In a very complicated, that had as much to do with my boyfriend as anything else. I'm sorry to say that, but that's true.
Well, that's the way it is for a lot of people.
And I got a degree in classical Greek and had was beginning graduate school in Greek at Stanford. And I went away with my new boyfriend, who is now my husband. We went to Mexico, and we were driving back from Mexico. And I said, you know, I don't think I want to do this. And he said, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I've always wanted to be an actor. And he said, why don't you do that?
Good for him.
And so I came back and dropped out of school and did that. I began to study with someone in San Francisco and sort of by hook or by crook in a long way, finally ended up in New York when I was 28. And I began to study with Wynne Handeman. We were married and when I was 21 and went to live in Europe for about 4 years. And I studied in Italy with a man named Alessandro Fersen in Rome. And then we went to live in Woodstock for a little while and had our second child. And then moved to New York. And I interviewed with Wynne Handeman on my 28th birthday.
Huh. I usually do rock music reviews for the show, so I would be remiss if I didn't say I was very interested to see that your son David is the bass player in a very good band called The Neels.
Yes, it is, isn't it?
Yes. how do you feel about him? How did you feel when he first became involved in rock and roll and performing this way?
Well, since I grew up, I was born in 1945, so I'm a 60s kid. I grew up with rock and roll, and David has played the guitar since he was seven with the full approval of all members of his family. Henry, my husband, used to sing him to sleep, playing guitar music. And David, from the age of, I think, seven, the first thing he saw when he woke up every morning was a huge poster of Jimi Hendrix. And he wrote, he was actually not allowed to write a junior high school paper on Keith Richards. He was asked to write a biography of a person who had been important in his life, and he said Keith Richards, and the teacher said, that's not serious.
Huh.
And we all went to school and said, are you kidding?
Good for
it's
you.
As serious as it can be.
Right. And the other thing I was wondering about is that your resume is full of this very rich, varied roles that you've played in the theater. You don't seem to have done too much in film. I wonder how you maintain that kind of career in the theater and finding roles that are challenging and to sustain a career like that.
I've been immensely lucky in the writers who have found me.
Mm-hmm.
My first sort of big job in New York was Jules Pfeiffer.
Mm-hmm.
Then I was in Sister Mary, Christopher Durang.
Mm-hmm.
I did Larry Kramer's Just Say No.
Mm-hmm.
I've done a number of plays by Romulus Linney.
Yeah.
Ellen McLaughlin, and now Margaret Edson. So I've been immensely fortunate.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to be better for me now that I'm over 50 than it was before.
Yes.
So, again, fortunate.
Yes, I guess that cliche of that in the movie industry and to a certain extent in television, the roles are for young women primarily. There's a much wider range of roles for middle-aged women in the theater. Would you agree?
Well, it seems to be so, because I've been working pretty steadily, mm-hmm. actually since I was 40. Mm-hmm. I do think that as the demographics, as they say, change in the world, there are going to be more and more roles for people older and older. I think that's beginning to happen.
Kathleen Chalfant, star of the off-Broadway play Wit,